Hello everyone, welcome to the Scientific Sense podcast, where we explore emerging ideas from science, policy, economics, and technology. My name is Gil Epen. We talk with world's leading academics and experts about their recent research or general areas of topical interest. Scientific Sense is an unstructured conversation with no agenda or preparation. We cover a wide variety of domains where new discoveries are made and new technologies are developed on a daily basis. We are most interested in how ideas affect society and help educate the world how to pursue a rewarding and enjoyable life rooted in science, logic, and information. We seek knowledge without boundaries and constraints and provide unedited content of conversations with researchers and leaders who love what they do. A companion blog to this podcast can be found at scientificsense.com. And this podcast is available on over a dozen platforms and directly at scientificsense.net. If you have suggestions for topics, guests, and other ideas, please send them to info@scientificsense.com. And I can be reached at gil@epen.info. My guest today is Professor Jeffrey Pinto, who is Professor of Management and Chair in Management Technology at Penn State University. His research interests include project management, governance, team dynamics in projects, burnout, leadership, and gender issues in project management selection. Welcome, Jeff.
Oh, thank you, Gil. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for doing this. So I want to start with something very topical in many ways. So reassessing project practices, research and theory in a post-COVID reality. So in this paper, you say the world is slowly emerging from a series of healthcare, financial and economic disruptions caused by the COVID-19 pandemic. While it's still too early to come to a definitive reckoning of a myriad ways in which our world has been forced to make adjustments in how it operates in pre and post-COVID, it's worth considering at least one aspect of post-COVID reality, its effects on project management practices and theory development. So this is not something I've thought about, Jeff. So yeah, I mean, clearly we had a huge discontinuity. Yeah. And we all lived through the supply chain issues that we had to deal with during COVID and post-COVID in many ways. And so it's sort of changing the psyche of society. And so it has a lot of implications how organizations think about projects in the future, I would imagine, right? So what do you find in this paper?
It's an interesting question because, like you say, Gil, there's so much that is still, the dust is still settling on so many different aspects of this. What I found in doing some of the initial research is that there's a whole bunch of dynamics that are all kind of commingling in this, so that it's very difficult to tease out and say this particular thing is happening because so many of these are mutually interrelated. Let me give you one example.
Yeah.
As you know, in the aftermath of COVID, major countries around the world were throwing, I shouldn't be facetious when I say this, but they were putting a lot of money into the marketplace. They were trying to minimize the disruptions. They were trying to make borrowing easier. They were trying to engage in a lot of new, very large projects. So yeah. You had in the U.S., for example, you had the Biden administration, and before them, to be fair, you had the Trump administration talking about trillion-dollar bills that were there to try and jumpstart the economy or keep the economy going. Well, somebody wants to spend that money. You know, there's a lot of money floating around. And so you have a lot of companies and a lot of governments, local governments, state governments at all different levels, who have their ideas about how we can spend a good chunk of that money. So one of the interesting side effects of this was a huge uptick in the number of these what we call mega projects of year-long or more duration, budgets of over $1 billion, massively complicated, lots of stakeholders, lots of moving parts. And we have a lot of these being proposed and being funded in different levels all around the country. So one interesting byproduct of COVID has not necessarily been to actually dampen these circumstances when projects are done. It's actually given rise to this huge increase in the interest in projects because there's a lot of money. There's a lot of money chasing projects out there to try and get things done. So on one meta level, we have an enhanced interest in large projects as a result of this, simply because that's where the money is going. Yeah. If you drill down into some of the specific dynamics, this is where things get quite interesting as a result of how you and I and companies have tried to pivot to become as flexible and responsive as possible. So one thing we all know is everyone had to stay home. So immediately virtual project management became a thing, and it became a thing in many companies quite virtually overnight, no pun intended, virtually overnight, because they had to suddenly go from co-located teams where everybody's in the same building and everyone had to disperse and go, and now let's do this virtually. You on your computer, me on mine, we're going to make the world work through Zoom calls. There's a lot of understandable responses to that. For example, some of it, and this is where things get a little bit weird again, generationally, younger generations took to this like a duck to water, and this is very comfortable for them. They understand it. They're very good with it. Other generations, myself included, or my generation, but you know, Gen X's and folks like that, they've had a tougher time, research has suggested, because this isn't how they operate. And to cite one example, we know from our research that engineers, for example, and if you think about organizations with lots of engineers in them, engineers love to tinker. They love to get their hands dirty. They love to work, but they also love to relate, to connect, to talk. And so we found some research going back years that says if you want to get a cross-functional team composed of lots of different people from different functional areas, if you want to get them to work together and cooperate, one critical dynamic there is physical proximity. Because engineers, they don't want to get on a phone if they could walk down the hall and pick your brain like that. And and again, I don't mean to pick on engineers, but you get the point, is that there are certain team dynamics that have gotten completely turned on their head.
So you're saying it's sort of a professionally driven in some ways. So I can relate to this, Jeff. So I was an engineer who went into economics. And I was at Hewlett Packard Company in the early 90s, where we had this huge manufacturing floors. We had no offices. And so I could just, you know, put my head up and then shout across the hall to go talk to somebody. And HP was, as you know, is a unique company, a unique American company in the 90s. But so engineers, as you say, I guess this need to sort of get into a conference room or something and, you know, sort of do some blackboard stuff. But the broader question is, so did we learn something from the Zoom regime where, you know, could we ask the question, is that really needed? I mean, could I cooperate with somebody in Japan, South Korea, India, and London, and perhaps I can become more productive that way? Do we have any data on that?
Yes, we do, actually. It's an interesting question, Gil, because as you put your finger on it, there was a whole subset of projects pre-COVID that were routinely done with non-co-located teams. In other words, these were spread out around the world where you might have your engineers in India, you might have design people in Scandinavia, you might have operations folks who were in Singapore or South Korea, and the others are in the US and you get the idea. I mean, they're all over the planet and they've been doing this for years. So for them, this is not a big leap. They're very comfortable with it. They understand the dynamics of doing it. The problem is, you and I the ones who are used to doing it a certain way are now being thrust into doing it in a very different way. So hence the Zoom call that we're talking about. And that's led to some real problems because, as you say, there was a learning curve involved in doing this. And it was a quite significant one for certain organizations to do that, because we had, you know, on the back end of it, isn't it fascinating that some large retailers, some large financial institutions, and some very big high tech companies are now kind of saying, okay, that was fine for a couple of years, but we want you back in the office now.
Yeah.
But the problem is, isn't it interesting? It's almost like Pandora's box. We've opened the box, you know, it's out. And now people are understanding, I can get a lot of work done in a home setting and I'm more comfortable there. Like right now, I'm talking to you and I have a nice shirt on, I have jeans on. You know, I can get away with that. You know, it's a different setting, but it allows me to be productive outside. Yeah. And people woke up, and a couple generations of workers have woken up to the fact that I don't need to be in the office to be productive.
Yeah.
And so they're having a very tough time now because, hey, you know, the kids are home. I like it here. Yeah. And now you want me there. And so Elon Musk and some other folks are saying, no, we want you in the office. And they're kind of like, don't really want to do that. So there are dynamics that have been released as a result of this. And, you know, for me to say, oh, don't worry, you know, we'll get back to whatever normal consists of, but we'll get back to normal in a couple of years. I don't really think that's the case. There's too much. There's too much that has happened in the meantime. And as long as people can realize it is possible to get the work done, it is possible to be part of a contributing team virtually, that's going to continue. But think about it this way, and I don't mean to go on and rhapsodize this too much, but the leadership qualities involved in doing this is a whole area that is just now being studied. And you know, in the old days, the project team leader did have a physical presence, and they did have the ability to be part of the team in a very real and immediate way. Now, in some cases, I hear people talking to me that they feel like they're network administrators as opposed to a project manager. I mean, I'm just booking phone calls and frantically taking notes and making sure it's done that way. So it's a very different setting. And it's bound to continue that way, I suspect.
That's really interesting, Jeff. So I haven't really thought about this. So the skills that we want to impart on, so your students, the skills that we focused on are sort of human-related skills.
Yes.
But there is a whole additional universe out there, parallel universe, that is valuing electronic skills a lot more. So they're not necessarily project managers in the traditional. You say it's a network administrators in some ways, right? So it's sort of a different thing altogether, right? So, yeah, I mean, it's an amazing thing. I mean, this is not in your research, but the commercial real estate values are plummeting in the U.S.
Yes.
Partly because of this phenomenon, you know, companies are realizing they can get almost as much productivity by getting rid of the downtown office. And you know, let people sit in the suburbs and interact. So yeah, so as you say, we're going through a transition here. It's not just transition in assets; it's also transition in skills. So that is sort of implication for education, right? I mean, well, how do you think about this?
It's an interesting question. There's as you say, the skills that we're starting to see emerge as a result of this there is a technical component of this, as you say. Now, I have to sort of say that, if you will, let me put it to you this way. My research going back to the 1980s, I have always been technology agnostic, if I could put it that way, when it comes to project management, because my research going back for decades, literally, has shown that technologies can only take you so far, and ultimately it is the people and the people skills of the project manager that are going to get the organization over the hump, get their project team over the hump. But having said that, the the changes in technology that we're seeing right now are so profound that I honestly don't know how the average person my age is really going to comfortably settle into that transition. We see, for example, APM, the Association of Project Management, PMI in the US, all these prognostications are relatively, I don't want to use the word scary, but they're startling when you think about AI and just the impact of artificial intelligence and how that's going to impact project management and the operations of projects. And one of the things I'm going to talk about, because I'm giving a keynote at this conference coming up next month on
the
on
IPMA conference,
the IPMA research conference. And one of the points I'm going to talk about there is there's two things going on. Number one, the if you think of a Venn diagram, the number of people who know project management are in this circle. The number of people who know AI are in this circle. And there's a very little sliver between them right now. We don't have a lot of, you know, merging of these two. I think it's getting better, but we're still kind of at this point where there's very little cross-fertilization going on. So that's one issue. The second point about it is that we're still in the application phase. In other words, we're still looking at what can AI do for us? And much of this, if we think about it, Gil, much of this is still very speculative. AI will be a great way for us to engage stakeholder communities. Okay, how? AI will be great for this. It'll be great for that. And in some cases, I can see it. I can see a logical reason why that would be the case. In others, I think, as I said, I think it's still a little more speculative. But for me, the interesting point is application is fine. But what I want to see when we talk about research and looking at AI in projects is I want to see this broadened out. I want us to understand what are the antecedent conditions. If you want to get AI to work in your organization, what do you have to do to make that happen? What kind of model, you know, process models for implementation? Who do you got to have to talk to? What are the critical success factors, content models for making that happen? Then I also want to talk about the consequences. Because we really don't have a good sense of what the, we're saying things like 80% of the people doing basic project management tasks won't have those jobs in 10 years. That's a frightening statistic. I don't know if it's true or not, but it's people throw that out there, and it raises some interesting points about a generation of project managers coming up. Let me illustrate one example. You and I learned how to be project managers by walking in the front door, getting assigned to low level work. You know, we came in as an assistant project administrator, a junior project engineer. We started at the bottom. We did a lot of scut work. We did a lot of the grinding and learning it and, you know, learning it on the job, but we started low and we developed our knowledge base by learning as we went. Now, when it's suggested that AI is going to take over 80% of the project management tasks in coming years, it raises an interesting question. How are we going to train a new generation of project managers? Because we're essentially sweeping away all of those low, if you will, low-level jobs, but the places where you and I got bloodied and learned how to do the work, those won't be available for them. So the question becomes, how are they going to learn to do project management?
This is a really philosophical question. And so, you know, there's a lot of talk around extraterrestrials. In effect, we are creating extraterrestrials in the sense that it doesn't work like what we used to think anymore.
Right.
And so different skills are needed, different technologies are needed, different ways of organizing the organizational structure of the organization. So incentives, I mean, it goes through the whole system, right? So
absolutely,
it's I don't know if there's any solution to this, but it's worth thinking about it, that project management, as you have researched for many decades, is changing, and it's changing dramatically.
Yes.
And so as a shareholder of a company, I want somebody who creates value from a team, But then I don't care if that person is, you know, in Silicon Valley or New York. But then that is not what these large companies have came to have come to believe, which is, so Yahoo, Tesla, Google, they all want their folks to come back because they built these big offices. that may be part of it, I don't know. But they all want them to come back because they believe productivity is higher when they're at close proximity. I have no data on this. So where do you stand on this?
Well, to your point, I mean, think about it. Imagine you're Apple. You've just finished building this massive circular building that's, you know, space age and just amazing. And within 6 months, you didn't even move into it and COVID hit. And so you're now frantically trying to backfill an enormous office space with people who really don't want to travel, because if you've ever been to the Bay Area, you know, it's tough to get around. Commuting is hell, and trying to find parking in neighboring communities and getting bused to the big donut is going to be a really interesting challenge. To your specific question, I really think that the jury is still very much out, I think, yeah, on what is likely to take place. If you're asking me personally, and again, generationally, I have to admit, this is going to be filtered through my generation. Generationally, I would say to you, you do need a physical presence at least some of the time, and for a variety of reasons related to what organizational life is, which is, you know, the team development and team dynamics and understanding the organizational politics and understanding all of these different characteristics that go into getting teams to work effectively together. Can you make this work virtually? Yes, but it's much more difficult, and it involves a lot more caretaking, I would suggest, on the part of team leaders to make sure that everything is getting done. It's easy to duck and to disappear in the ether, in the virtual setting. It's not as easy in a physical space.
Yeah, so this is not in your research, Jeff, but I want to get your perspective on this. So there are introverts and extroverts. And I have seen some research that showed that introverts became extremely happy post-COVID because, you know, they hated going to the office, standing by the water cooler. I mean, they get their work done really, really efficiently without interacting with a lot of humans.
Mm-hmm.
And the extroverts got depressed, really depressed, because their thing was actually humans. You know, they want to go to work and interact with humans. And so we have sort of two classes of people, and some gravitate towards sort of the electronic ways of doing things and the other way. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know the proportions of this in the population, but if one is dominating the other, then we will go in that direction ultimately, I would think, right?
Well, it's, if I remember the research in general terms, and this goes back to the days of Myers-Briggs. But if I remember, it's in the U.S., because it is definitely, there's some cultural interdependencies here. But in the U.S., if I remember the number correctly, it's the U.S. is 60% extrovert, 40% introvert. Okay, so we do tend more toward an extroverted culture. Yes, in those settings, you could see that certain people and certain extroverted personalities have a much tougher time because of this. They, as you say, their creativity, what gets the light bulb burning with them is the interaction, is the immediacy, is being able to gauge responses. And you can see that to a degree on a Zoom, but if you talk to any self-respecting extrovert out there who knows anything about body language and, you know, interacting with other people, they say, no, it's not the same. You know, it's just, it doesn't work in the same setting. Whereas you have your introverts who, as you just said, probably love this. They gravitate toward it. They enjoy they enjoy being left alone. Not that they're playing computer games, but that it's less distracting for them. And they're comfortable in their silence, and they're comfortable in contemplative activities. And so that's one thing. I alluded earlier to the fact that it's also generational. So you let think yeah. about you take an extroverted 60-year-old and they are thoroughly depressed because they don't like yeah. virtual connectivity anyway. And then on top of that, they just they hate this. Whereas other folks, you know, in modern generations, maybe or not maybe, we know the research suggests this, are much more content and facile and good at relating in an electronic means, because this is how they date. This is yeah. how they shop. This is yeah. how they look for houses. They look for clothing. They do this on a routine basis. So for them, this is just one other use that they can put their computer to.
Yeah, so I want to go into another paper, Jeff. So mm-hmm. this is another major bucket of ideas here. So the corruption of project governance through normalization of deviance.
Yeah.
So you say here, organizational mistakes and accidents have a long history in practice and have been studied extensively in the engineering and organizational literature. One of the primary causes of persistent organizational error is the existence of deviance, behavior violating organizational norms. So you have a number of examples here. I think a couple of papers here. So you have a number of examples here, you know, with mm-hmm. NASA and others. I was in a pharmaceutical company. I can give you some horror stories around this as well.
I'm sure.
And so this has been sort of a continuing theme, right, in large and complex systems, NASA being one of them. Let me ask you two questions. Let's get some data. And so you have a lot of examples here that we need to talk about. But the question is there a way to sort of manage it better? So that part, I'm not exactly sure. So let's talk about some examples that you have mentioned
sure.
in the paper.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of them that came immediately, and in fact, this is probably the more poignant one. So, you know, the one we're all familiar with, or most of us are familiar with, is the infamous Challenger disaster.
Oh, yeah.
And Diane Vaughan, who's a sociologist at Columbia, she studied this, the NASA, the culture. And this is what we're talking about, is organizational culture. See, she studied the culture at NASA, and she found it tended to be relatively risk-taking. It tended to reward people for getting, you know, doing what was necessary to get the work done. She saw that, you know, they were willing to skip steps, that they were willing to ignore the advice of their engineers who said, you really, these O-ring seals get brittle at freezing temperatures. You left the shuttle out overnight, bad move, ignored it all. And then we had the disaster with the Challenger. She wrote her book on this. We thought, okay, well, now we've identified this problem, so NASA's got their act together, right? Well, along comes some years later, not that many years later, and the Space Shuttle Columbia yeah. has a similar situation. If you recall, in that situation, every time the Columbia would launch, they had this foam, and they call it foam. Don't think of like a bed. It's not soft foam. It's very hard foam. That yeah. was all around the fuel tanks to keep them insulated. And every time this space shuttle would launch, sheets of this foam would shed off during the launch itself, and they would tumble to the ground or they would strike the underside of the space shuttle. And it'd been going on for a long time. It was never supposed to happen. That was yeah. never planned to occur, but it was occurring. It didn't seem like it was a problem, so we just let it happen, and we just sort of wrote that down.
So it was occurring. Sorry, Jeff. Interrupt. Yeah. So it was occurring in simulations, or it was occurring in sort of real tests.
Real examples, real launches. So there had been many cases of launches of other Space Shuttle Freedom, you know, all the other space shuttles, where this foam was shedding off in very dramatic sheets of this stuff coming off. And if you go back and you look at some launches of some of these shuttles, you'll see just when they're going into liftoff, you'll see all this white stuff cascading down. And you're thinking, what is that stuff? It was this foam. Well, in this case with Columbia, it was striking the underside, but it had been striking undersides of these shuttles for several launches. And nobody thought anything of it because it hadn't mattered. Until in this case, it did matter because it dislodged several of the heat tiles that allowed the shuttle to re-enter atmosphere, and it burned up on reentry, as we know, that awful story. And so we come back full circle. So NASA, we thought, learned their lesson. They had a culture that was risk-taking and allowed, you know, avoided checks and balances and did dumb things and had safety issues and all this. Well, they've learned their lesson, haven't they? Well, they hadn't learned their lesson.
Yeah.
It's
the incentives in the system.
You're absolutely right, because this is something we know about cultures in general, and that is what we know this about human behavior in general, and that is you get the kind of behavior from people that you reward them for. And people tend, if I'm reinforced to operate in these ways, I'll operate in these ways. So this is human behavior 101. I mean, this goes back forever, that we know that this is supposed to happen, and yet it was being allowed to occur. And so the phrase that I used for this was that the unexpected, you know, in this case, this tiles falling, the unexpected becomes the expected. Now we start, it's going to happen, which becomes the accepted. So it goes from the unexpected becomes the expected, which becomes the accepted. Now it's just part of what we do. The sad example, I'm sorry, go ahead.
There's an irony for me, Jeff, is that suppose we replace all the humans at NASA with artificial intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
I think we get better outcomes because they don't have emotions. They don't have incentives. They are sort of, you know, skewed in one way or the other. So suppose the AI is, you know, basically about engineering and physics, then we will potentially get better. I mean, I'm making a statement here, right?
Yes, but the flaw in that reasoning, Gil, is that we also have to remember that AI is learning. It's constantly in learning mode. And just like human beings learn, the danger is, do they learn like we do to ignore divergent data because it doesn't seem to matter until it suddenly does matter? I've been an expert witness now in two lawsuits where I was at, on the basis of the research I've done here. And in both cases, a large corporation, obviously I can't talk about it, but a large corporation had a member of that organization die in industrial accidents. And in both of those cases, it had to do with the fact that the culture there was this attitude of, if you remember the old Larry the Cable Guy term, get her done. And their whole approach to project was get her done. And they were rewarding project managers who got it done fast, not the ones who exercised safety controls, but the ones who got it done fast. So think for people listening to this, think of the last time a company came and painted your house and you're outside watching a guy on a ladder on his way up there. And he, rather than come down the ladder and move it, he starts hopping it along the wall. And you go, oh my gosh, don't. He'd say, I've been doing this for years. It's fine. Well, it's fine until it's not fine, but it's a bad practice that he's been able to get away with, and his company's allowed. They've looked the other way because, you know, hey, we're getting the painting done quick. So that's the problem, is the culture has rotted inside where we're not enforcing, and we're not, and here's the point to what you said earlier, we're not rewarding correctly. We're rewarding, we're creating perverse incentives, where the incentive here is not safety. The incentive is completion fast or completion cheap or something like that.
Yeah, so incentives are easy to understand. Culture is more complex.
Mm-hmm.
And culture starts at the top of an organization, I would argue.
Absolutely.
So we're going through this Boeing disaster as we speak. And a new CEO came in to fix the place, quote unquote, and nothing has been fixed, actually. Fundamentally, it's an issue of culture, right? So, you know, so what you say here in the paper is really about you can normalize bad behavior over time. Mm-hmm. So I got 15 nuts and bolts here. I put 14 of them. The last one, nothing happened to the other aircrafts.
Exactly.
The last one. Yeah. I mean, that's what we are seeing, right, in some ways?
Very much so, Gil. And to your point, and I agree with you, I think the problem with the CEO in this situation is the CEO is like the manager of a baseball team or a basketball team. When the team is performing well, they get a lot of credit for that, probably more than they deserve. When the team is performing badly, they get a lot of the blame for that. Again, probably a little more than they deserve. Because coming in, what happens is, we know this, is that I can come in and I can send out memo after memo, and I can make sure that there's these cool posters that are in every lunchroom and, you know, we care and all. And it's meaningless, because at the end of the day, what your employees look at are a couple of things. Number one, what are we really being rewarded for around here? And they know this far better than you and I do. And they get it quickly. So they know what matters. And the way they know this is this concept, and this goes back, the research on this goes back decades in culture, is looking at critical incidents. So if you were to say for me, for example, Gil, tell me about HP, what you would tend to do is you would tend to give me your thumbnail explanation of what it's like to work there by citing some examples that to you typify what it's really like. Yeah. And so those examples may be very positive. You know, when we have a problem here at my old university, there used to be, it's no longer there, but GE Transportation had a very large locomotive manufacturing facility there. And I would talk to engineers there and I'd ask them, what's it like to work here? And they would say things like, oh my gosh, I mean, it's every man, you know, it's all hands on deck. For example, when we've got a big order out, the plant manager, who's a high six-figure guy, plant manager, is in an environmental suit there on the deck, and he's running a spray painted can along with everybody else. I mean, and they just say it's all about us and we work jointly. Yeah. And you contrast that with other companies where they say, oh, well, there's rules for those people up there and then the rest of us down here. And so you learn from those critical incidents what really matters. Yeah. And that's what's occurring, is we reward certain behaviors. People pick up on it and they learn, it does safety really matter? Does honesty really matter? Is it okay to fleece the company, or is it okay to double bill our customers? Because it's kind of fun. We can get away with it. It looks good. You know, at the end of my quarter, my numbers look good.
Yeah. I can quite relate to this, Jeff. So large companies with headquarters in major cities, typically, they have a C-level, as you know, a C-level floor.
Yeah.
And, you know, the lift from there goes all the way to the basement, doesn't stop at any other floor. This is sort of the class structure, class system.
Yes.
That has gotten many companies into trouble, right? I mean, so if there is no sort of relationship between top execs and, you know, people who are doing the job, I think it's a big problem. I don't know how, I mean, I don't want to harp on Boeing, but I don't know how other companies are, you know. My sense, Jeff, you may have more data on this. My sense is that the high-tech companies are a little better on this. Do you have a sense for that or no?
I can't say that I know that for sure. I can say to your point, because I think you raise an interesting surmise, that first of all, you and I both know that right now Boeing is frantically running root cause analysis all over their place. And they're trying to get to the bottom of this. What's actually happening? Why has this been occurring? What is the source? Because they're trying to find that. If you can get the root cause, that's at least a step now toward fixing the problem. I think maybe in the case with a Boeing or a Lockheed Martin or a General Dynamics, you know, one, and I don't mean to pick just an aerospace, you can add anything else to it too, but it's incredibly complicated. Their projects that they run and just their production facilities and all these steps are hugely, hugely complicated. I used to do some consulting work with Rolls-Royce out of Indianapolis, their jet engines. And I mean, phenomenally successful company, but they have to watch every step of the process. You know, every step there, you can't take anything for granted. You have to vet it. You have to make sure it was done correctly. And there's people looking to make sure that's done. How do you get that? Partially, it's a buy-in from every level of the organization. You know, it's not the people at the bottom who are just, you know, banging, you know, instead of putting a screw in, just hammer it in because I can get more screws done that way. it's recognizing how you get what you reward. And yeah. So I think, you know, yes, I would love to be a fly on the wall right now in Boeing and listen to what's going on there as they're yeah. pulling this apart to understand how did things get to this point.
Yeah, so I just touched on something very quickly, Jeff. So do you see some sort of a spiraling effect? So I'm thinking about project management, portfolio management more generally.
Mm-hmm.
So the culture is a big issue. I mean, we talked about that. But once you go in some direction, are you going in some direction that you cannot really pull back? I mean, it's like, so you change the CEO, but it's not going to do anything because you're already, you know, you're going from 50,000 to 30,000 feet, changing the, you know, the pilot is really not going to help that much, right? I mean, do you see it that way, or there's something the CEO could do?
It's a good question. There's two answers to this. There's definitely research that suggests that CEOs under certain circumstances do have a lot of ability to move the rudder, to get the ship moving in another direction. It is not, as you can imagine, an overnight process because they're yeah. coming into a situation with a lot of embedded resistance. So your first step in many cases like that is finding out who are your allies, who are the ones who are opposed to you, and basically cleaning your own house before you can attempt to clean the larger house. It's a very difficult process to make that happen. Having said that, I do believe it is possible to make those shifts, but isn't it interesting when we think about CEOs that have a certain dynamism that seem to pull this off almost effortlessly? And of course, yeah. it's not the case, but you think of a Jack Welch back in the day, and you think yeah. of an Elon Musk in this day and age, and you say to yourselves, wow, it's just, but these people exude energy.
Mm.
They don't hide behind the sort of corporate bureaucrat model. They are quite literally everywhere, ubiquitous. They're all through their system. You never know when they're going to pop up. You never know and they're polymaths. They're brilliant. They know a lot about a lot of different things. They can inspire. This is a phenomenally rare commodity. And when you yeah. can find it in those folks, you understand to a degree. I mean, I look at an Elon Musk, for example, and I just shake my head. I say, I don't know, you know, clearly I don't know how he does it because he's worth a whole lot more than I am. But I don't know how he finds the time to move from SpaceX to Tesla to, you know, one venture after another. And he's equally enthusiastic and embedded in all of them. I think the head of Boeing has got to come in, and he's got to be very dynamic about his approach. If he falls back on sort of corporate speak and hiding in the C-suite and all these other things, I think, like you say, there's too many levels, and his message will get diffused every step of the way it goes down the ladder, to the point where what he said here, that night is, you know, black, is going to come down here to day is black. It's just too many levels unless he's actually managing the message.
So I want to ask one more question before we go into another topic. So what you say has sort of implications for corporate boards. And so, you know, if the company is underperforming, company has problems, they have to think about maybe changing the CEO or something like that. But it is not, as you say, it's not mathematical. You need somebody who can inspire, as you say.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're transitioning, if you're changing mm-hmm. from X to Y, it is not going to be a typical, you know, sort of, let me get all my spreadsheets out and do the numbers type thing, right? I mean, that is what the corporate boards appear to be missing.
I think that's true. I think that the other problem is that sometimes we minimize the selection process. Now, let me put in this proviso. My research, I don't do a lot of research on corporate board activities. So much of what I know is really more from reading than actually having done the research on it. But having said that, we know certain things that do pop up in a lot of boards tend to be passive boards. Okay. They yeah. don't really push any sort of agenda on their own. They tend to be stocked with the picks of the CEO and the chairman and these folks. And so they're not going to move the needle very much.
Right.
The other problem with boards many times is that they get it wrong. They just make bad selections, and they do it with seemingly good reasons. If you think of John Sculley, when he went to Apple, yeah. he was an executive from Pepsi Cola. Okay. Yeah, very good at Pepsi Cola.
He was a great guy. Yeah.
Great guy.
But not for Apple. Yeah.
But he got to Apple and he was completely out of his element. And he just, the way, and this was a corporate conceit in America for decades, was that a good executive is a good executive is a good executive. And it doesn't matter where they are. You can put them in this job, in this job, in this job. And we know, generally speaking, that doesn't work with high tech. They just, a lot of times we try doing that and it just doesn't work. And you need a certain personality. Now, to your question about boards, do boards understand that? Some of them do, but again, I'm a little bit skeptical about the degree to which a board can genuinely can exert enough pressure on a CEO to make them alter course, unless things are really, really bad. Mm-hmm. At the point where it's either do it, you know, you have to make changes or else. And then what's to say the board has a better view on what should be done? Mm-hmm. They just know that their stock options are getting worth less and less.
So I'm going to go to another topic. So another paper, you have hundreds of years of pain with minimal gain, capital project cost overruns, the past, present, and optimistic future, you say here.
Yeah.
So the cost overrun phenomenon plagues capital projects worldwide. While policymakers and practitioners are aware of the potential for cost overruns to occur, while procuring their projects, they have struggled to mitigate them. And then, you know, you're sort of looking at two horizons here, 1960 to 2002, and then 2002-2022. So what are you finding from these data sets?
Well, it's a big question because there's a lot involved here. Let's start off with a simple statement, premise, if you will, that is easily defended. And that is that the larger the project, typically, the worse of a job we do managing it. And when I say worse job, what I mean is the end result tends to be horrific overruns, schedule delays, incredibly bad, minimal functionality, or the functionality is not what we'd hoped for, or something like that. Now, I'm just citing three metrics here, time, cost, and quality. If we add in stakeholder satisfaction, if we add in benefits or value creation or things like that, again, the story can be very muddied and very muddled. And so, for example, think about if those people from the Boston area, and think about the Big Dig, which finally was completed in 2008 after running a decade over schedule. And the original budget was supposed to be $1.6 billion. And the final budget was $14.5 billion. It's just unbelievable.
They deployed a lot of bad engineers from MIT, Jeff. I mean,
Maybe that was it, or maybe we have to recognize that some researchers have pointed to for a long time, and that is a lot of these initial project estimates are not worth the paper they're printed on. They're unduly optimistic to the point where they just create something that, who are we kidding? But we still accept it. They tend to be not based on so much cost analysis as based on a whole string of best case scenarios put together. And the end result is that we get our hopes up for something that's, you know, it's going to look at what this is going to do for us, only to be crushingly disappointed or to have it canceled or something else. Think, for example, most recently about California High Speed Rail.
Yeah.
that was, you know, when the Obama administration gave them $8 billion to the California government to start this process, and they were going to create a high-speed rail network that ran all the way from San Francisco down to L.A., that was sounded like that was the greatest thing in the world. But the original cost estimates were nonsensical. We can do this for $30 billion. We've got $8 billion from the federal government. We only have to scrape together $22 billion over the next 4 or 5 years, worst case. So everyone said, agreed to this bond issue. So the government got the bond issue voted on. And it was a chimera. It was smoke and mirrors. From the very beginning, it was just a mirage. And the more people that came in, the independent analysts who looked at this said, $30 billion. The number right now we've got is about $100 billion and climbing, because you don't have no idea what you're getting yourself into. And politicians ignored this. Jerry Brown, you know, he loved the idea of high-speed rail, and so he did not want to hear negative commentary. Finally, you know, it was canceled. You know, the irony of the cancellation is it wasn't completely canceled, if you remember. Gavin Newsom is allowed a 50-mile stretch. Well, and he's allowed them to complete a 50-mile stretch from Merced to Bakersfield. Now, if you look at a map of California, and no offense to people who live in Bakersfield and Merced, but these are two cities almost in the middle of nowhere. They're in the valley. And they're far away from the major population areas. By the way, do you know what that final budget is going to be just for that stretch of road? $30 billion.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
And
so I want to ask you this, Jeff. So is there a cultural issue here, too, which is the U.S. appear to be very incompetent in terrestrial transportation? Let me make a big statement here. Japan has a new train out that's going to travel a kilometer every 8 seconds, a maglev, you know, magnetically levitated train. Are we in the U.S. really sort of incompetent in terrestrial transportation?
No, you know what? It's an honest question, Gil. And I would say the answer is no. I would say that, for example, every example of the U.S. that I can cite, I have a lot of colleagues that I work with in the UK, and they can talk there about, well, high speed two, it's called high speed two. So they originally, the first high speed rail was to connect London to Birmingham. Then they were talking about branching off and going up to Manchester, going out, you know, even potentially as far up as Newcastle, but they were going to extend it. So high speed two was the big thing. They just very quietly canceled high speed two last October. Because the costs were escalating astronomically, and it was just to the point where it was no longer financially viable. They just finished a new line in London called the Crossrail, and this is the Elizabeth line there. It cost billions of dollars billions of pounds overruns in getting that accomplished, to the point where finally the executive committee had to fire the project manager as a goodwill gesture to prove that we're serious about finally getting our act together.
So,
to your point is, no, I think that now, does the U.S., are we definitely behind the curve with infrastructure, especially public transportation? Absolutely. We're a big country, and so we don't have the experience of understanding how to do this on a cost-effective basis, because we're all about distance in this country. We're not really about understanding urban transportation nearly to the degree that, for example, is in China or Japan or even in parts of Europe.
It's really puzzling because we have all the technology in the world, but we haven't been able to sort of put that into practice, especially in terrestrial transportation. I would argue that it's because we don't really want to do it, in the sense that we like our cars, and some people are driving around with electric cars now and saving the environment. But we like sort of private transportation. We never liked public transportation. And so there's no will, there's no desire to improve public transportation, I would argue. Where do you come out on this?
That's an interesting question. I think there's partially the answer to that question is it's unfortunately been allowed to become a political issue. So the way our country, the parties have splintered is we're losing that middle ground of people who can talk to each other, and we become a party of action. We become a two-party system of action and reaction, action and reaction. So if they like it, we have to be against it. So when Obama proposed the high-speed rail initiative, and initially California jumped on it and got their $8 billion, he then went to Florida and said, do you want money to go from Orlando to Tampa? That'd be a good place. And Florida, which is more Republican, said, no, we don't want your money. It's a stupid idea. We're not going to invest in it. So no. So that was a political decision as much as anything else. Beyond that, to your specific point, I think that there is a sense of jadedness on the part of some people, and it's a cynicism that comes about, which I think honestly is unfortunate. I mean, what I try and tell people is COVID pumped a lot of money into this country, into these exact kinds of projects to be done. The money is sitting there. I've talked to folks, I have some contacts in the Department of Energy, who shall be nameless, but they are sitting on a pot of money right now, of billions, I mean, with a B, billions of dollars in seed money and significant seed money. I mean, to capitalize a lot of sustainable projects, a lot of green projects, a lot of these kinds of things, and they can't give the money away. And they're worried because in 6 months' time or 9 months' time, that money's going to roll back into the treasury. So they have money, they're soliciting bids, and they're not hearing any. I mean, they're hearing the sound of crickets chirping. So the money's there, but for whatever reason, the will just doesn't seem to be there as well. I don't understand it, but again, you know, you can't discount politics, unfortunately.
No, that drives everything. So I want to finish up with the last paper that you have here. So no project should ever finish late, you say, and why yours probably will. Anyway, so projects continue to offer a superior means for organizations to realize many advantages, including improving internal operations, achieving commercial success, and fostering greater society benefits. In spite of the enthusiasm with which these projects are undertaken, in company after company, there's a clear evidence of chronic underperformance, frustrating project managers and making efforts to achieve success difficult. Yeah, so I'm very familiar with this concept, Jeff. So padding time and money on every project step is a dominant decision for any project manager, because he or she is not going to get rewarded by bringing the projects exactly on time and exactly on budget. And so padding has been a big aspect, right? So what you're arguing here is that no project will come on time because of a variety of issues. So how do you get here?
Okay, so this is the result of a lot of years of consulting work, of training in corporations, of listening to people just like yourself, Gil, who shrug and say, yeah, that's just the way it is. But underlying why we pad, there's a couple reasons. And when we're talking about padding, for people who are not aware of this, what we're saying is that if I do an honest to goodness duration estimate for an activity, and I say this will take me about 24 hours worth of work, well, I don't tell you it's going to take 24. I say it's going to take 30 or 32 or something like that, because I need that extra, and it's self-preservation behavior, but I need that extra time. Now, I'm not doing it so I can waste that time. But some of the reasons we pad, as you well know, is I'm multitasking like crazy. I may have 5, 6, 7 projects I'm involved in. So you're asking me how long this activity would take. If you were asking me, assuming I left you alone, Jeff, and don't bother you for anything but doing this by itself, then I might be inclined to say 24 hours worth of work. But I know you're not going to do that to me. You're going to say, well, okay, fine, so I want you to do it. So I'm not going to tell you 24 hours, because that's going to make me look bad. So I'm going to say 32 or even 35 or something, like, to allow for the time that I'm going to have to do this shoehorned around everything else. And we work this right up the ladder. So, for example, I had a boss who used to, he would ask what were our duration estimates were. That 24 hours that I gave you, he would immediately shave 20% off because he assumed I was padding. He assumed it as part of this negotiation. So I say 24 hours. He said, no, I can give you 18. Well, you know what? People aren't stupid. And it takes me all of about 5 minutes to figure out his game. And then we talk among ourselves, and everyone knows that, yes, Stu does this. If you tell him a number, he's going to shave 20%. Well, guess what happens next time he asks me for an estimate? I factor that in. So I've got all these ways that I'm padding to add time to my schedule. Now, you ask the question, then why a project late? You've just admitted you've padded this thing like crazy, so you've got all this extra time. So what happened on the back end? Well, certain things happen on the back end, as we know. And again, this is where I love talking about human behavior, because human behavior is so fascinating, endlessly fascinating in what we end up doing here. So I've got this now. I get started. Well, no, I don't really get started. Remember about the pad, about the multitasking. I got other stuff going on. So think about when you wrote a term paper in college. You had 14 weeks. You knew it was due in 14 weeks. Did you start week one? No, you have other things going on, the Frisbee tournaments this week, and all, you know, there's lots of reasons.
A lot of uncertainty.
So there's a learning curve. I have to figure out how to do this. So there's a lot of ramping up that's going to take place. So the actual work, I may get halfway through that. You know, I said to you 24 hours, I may be 12 hours into this, and I haven't done anything really that amounts to anything, because I'm learning how to do it. And so you see this massive ramp up that occurs at the end of the process, where all of a sudden everything kicks in, panic, let's not negate that, all these other things, but everything kicks in at that point in time. And so you see that behavior. The other behavior you see is when I think something's going to come in late, bosses have one of two responses to, they're afraid they're going to come in, this is going to come in late, okay? So they do one of two things to it. Number one is they throw resources at it, right? So remember your old days when you have five people working on an activity and it's running late. And so the boss panics and he adds two more people. Well, the net effect is these two people now have to learn how to do this. So I've just, these people have to train them. So now I've just taken two people off the board. I now have the net effect of three people working on that activity. And it's getting later and later. So I panic some more and I add two more people and you get the idea. And so this is something called Brooks' Law. And some of us are familiar with this term. And it goes way back to the 60s. But it's a fascinating point where he said, adding resources to ongoing activities, ones that are happening now, adding resources only delays them further. It's so counterintuitive, but it's so true. So we're talking in this paper, what I'm doing is talking about, why do we spend all this time padding? Then, which is why no project should ever finish late. But then we waste all this time on the back end, which ultimately causes it to be late. You know, the people are wonderful this way. We do this, but then we do this.
Yeah, so I really like this, Jeff. So we solved this problem in the mid-90s in a large pharmaceutical company. We were investing about $4 billion a year into R&D programs. And 40 different department managers would come to meetings. And it's a negotiation process, as you say. So, you know, I have my number and I say it's 40 million. And the top guys say, no, no, I cannot have 40, you know, maybe 38. And he or she will say, oh, that's okay. I'll try to make it with 38. But her number was like 20.
Yeah.
Right. So what we did was to say, we're going to not have managers make budgets or timelines. We're going to have an artificial intelligence program, a machine learning program, do this. And so out of the fax machine, this is in the mid-90s, comes a schedule that's based on all the historical data, last 100 years that we have internalized. And then that's your budget, that's your project plan. And we're going to measure you against that. As you can imagine, I had to, you know, walk around the company with bulletproof vests for obvious reasons. And so Yeah, so it is, I mean, we have technology now that could actually alleviate this problem. But middle managers don't like this idea that, you know, technology is going to make them more efficient, I would think.
I had a teacher one time. He was a consultant, but I learned a lot from him. And he used to talk about, to the point you're making, that he said, if you don't take my estimates seriously, very quickly, I'm going to learn to not give you serious estimates.
Yeah.
And if you don't take them seriously, I'm not going to give you serious ones. I'm going to give you a number that you think you want. And then later on downstream, okay, you know, you can beat me up, but so be it. Now, what you're saying about historical data is really interesting, because in the UK, for example, they evaluate project proposals by putting them through an inflator number. It's called reference class forecasting, RCF, reference class forecasting. And the argument is, if you want to know how long it's going to take to build that bridge or build that motorway or whatever, why not look at the database of other projects similar to this one to see what happens? And what they find, no surprise, is people tend to underestimate because of optimism, because of whatever reasons, there's a lot of them, they underestimate those numbers. And so they put them through an inflator and they say, okay, you think it's going to be 100 million pounds? No, according to this, if you want a 50-50, because it's confidence intervals, if you want a 50-50 chance of making that, it should be 158 million. Now that raises another question. Will the government still go for 158 million? They were okay with 100 million, but now, you know, this is where things get funny. So to your point, you know, data is a funny thing and data is a scary thing, because we can use it. We can use it as a friend, or we can use it as the worst enemy of a project if we're not careful.
Yeah, absolutely. Excellent, Jeff. Yeah, thanks so much for spending time with me.
Oh, you're very welcome. I appreciate the questions, Gil. It's a fascinating area.
And I'll see you in the IPMA conference. That's right. University of Maryland.
My old alma mater, I might add too. I went to the University of Maryland, so it'll be fun being there after way too many years that I don't want to think how long it's been.
It's a big campus. I've been there a couple of times. It's really huge.
It's campus. Huge.
Yeah.
Yes, it is. You can get a lot of exercise just walking from Wayne.
Excellent. Thanks again.
You're very welcome, Gil. Have a great day, and I look forward to seeing you in a couple weeks.
Thank you.